As Francis Bacon said, you can actually read both of God's books, the book of God's words, the Bible, the book of God's works, which is nature. And that's what science is charged with understanding. And so scientists are worshiping when they do that. And if I can be remembered as having made that point, that would be pretty good.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. You've joined us for The Profile, where we sit down with a different Christian every week and hear something of their life story. I'm really pleased to say that my guest on the show this week is Francis Collins. He is a world-renowned scientist and New York Times best-selling author. Dr. Collins was involved in the identification of the genetic cause of cystic fibrosis in 1989, and he also led the Human Genome Project. As director of the National Institutes of Health in the USA, he served under Presidents Obama, Trump, and Biden. And when COVID-19 struck in the spring of 2020, he organized and led a group working 100-hour weeks alongside many other scientists to find answers. And that, of course, did lead to the development, testing, and emergency approval of two COVID vaccines. We're going to talk plenty about that today. Dr. Collins says that he believes this will be judged by future historians as one of the greatest medical achievements in human history. We're here as well to talk about Dr. Collins' new book, The Road to Wisdom, on truth, science, faith, and trust. Dr. Francis Collins, it's a pleasure to meet you. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Sam. Glad to be with you for this conversation. Hello to everybody who's listening.
We last spoke to you in the middle of the pandemic. It was my then colleague, Justin Briley, and I remember we headlined the interview in the magazine as "The Christian Scientist Looking for a COVID Vaccine." Huh. Now, this is 5 years ago, and plenty has happened since. As everybody will be aware, those vaccines were, of course, found. Can you maybe just get across to those of us who aren't medically or scientifically trained just how monumental an achievement that was?
It was indeed. Until this experience, no vaccine against a threatening infectious disease had ever been developed in less than 5 years. Many of them took even longer than that, 10 years or even 15. And yet here we were faced with the worst pandemic in more than a century in the early parts of 2020, and a vaccine was our best hope to try to save lives. People have kind of forgotten how awful it was in early 2020 because we kind of suppressed those things. But it was. The hospitals were overloaded with people they couldn't take care of. In some hospitals, their morgue was so full they had to bring in refrigeration trucks just to handle all the dead bodies. It was like a nightmare for our whole world. And the best chance we had to try to do something about it, although if it was going to take 5 years, it wasn't going to be very successful, was to build a vaccine that would be effective in preventing the worst consequences of this COVID virus. So we built that upon a strategy of mRNA technology, which had been under development for 25 years. Because it hadn't previously gotten much attention, some people thought we just made it up, but it was around for a while and had been very carefully tested in other systems and animal models. And it seemed like the best bet to be able to get this quickly, because you didn't need to even have the virus in your lab to start building a vaccine. You just needed to know the letters of its genome sequence. And when those were released on January 10th, 2020 by the Chinese, the whole thing started. And within 48 hours, the vaccine that ended up being the Moderna vaccine had been designed by our scientists at NIH. And then it went through what was required, testing in animals, then a phase 1 human trial, then a big scale up to a trial of 30,000 people, half of whom got the vaccine, half of whom got a dummy shot, and they didn't know which one they got. And then we had to track and see, okay, did it work? And late November of 2020, on a night I will never forget, the blinding was taken off so you could actually see who had gotten the vaccine. And oh my gosh, the vaccine was 95% effective in preventing severe disease and hospitalization and death, 100% against death. So much better than any of us had dared to dream. As a person of faith, I had prayed about that entire year, and this felt like prayers had been answered. Science had turned out to be the way in which those prayers were answered, but there was the data. So, yeah, I do think historically, you could sort of ask, what are the moments where science rose to the occasion? This instance, saving lives, estimate between 14 and 20 million lives saved across the world, 3 million of them in the United States. And I don't know that there's another example where that has quite turned out in such an urgent crisis to have been the case.
It's interesting you talk about your prayers for that year, because I remember quite a senior church leader saying, this is God's gracious provision. This is the providence of God that we have a vaccine to be able to offer the country, the world even. Yes. You clearly felt the same, that this was something that God had allowed the scientific community to come together and develop this so quickly.
Absolutely. As a Christian who's a scientist, I think of science as a means of exploring God's creation. And God gives us curiosity and he gives us talents to try to sort things out, but it's all God's creation that we're trying to bring to bear on human suffering. So it is a way that prayer gets answered, is that yeah. scientific approach turns out, as in this instance, to be remarkably successful.
And just tell me about that time for you personally, because I was reading it was 100-hour weeks, which is understandable given the emergency situation. But these things must have taken a toll on you personally in your own personal life. How did you look after yourself when there was so much pressure on you and on your team? Mm.
It was that way, and I'm glad then and now that as somebody with a background standing on the rock of my Christian faith, that would see me through the storm. I would wake up often after a short night, and the first thing I would do would be to do some prayer and reading of a bit of scripture and get myself grounded in what is really true and what it is that we're called to do as children of God. And that would be the place I would go to when things started falling apart, because they often did during the course of a day, where something you had hoped for didn't work, or a partner that you were counting on decided they weren't going to work with you after all. It was a challenging year. But for the most part, it was an amazingly inspiring year. People just dropped a lot of their usual concerns about, am I going to have to work really hard? Am I going to get credit for it? No, everybody wanted to do everything they could to try to save lives. And that taught me some really important lessons about the goodness and the nobility of humanity when given the chance to show itself.
And now that we're some years on, I think people have reflected on that time. And it's interesting to hear you say that we forget, which I think is true, we forget just how bad it was in 2020. Nevertheless, though, over 50 million adult Americans declined vaccination. Yes. Vaccination was made available free in your country and my country. You could go and you could get it. You were encouraged to by the authorities. But not only did millions of people decline, but millions of evangelicals. I know you've said in particular in the US, white evangelical Christians were the most resistant religious group.
Yes.
Did that take you by surprise at the time?
It did. And I found it pretty heartbreaking as a white evangelical myself. But I guess maybe in retrospect, this was somewhat predictable. The tensions between evangelical Christians and science have been there for, 150, 200 years, maybe going back to Darwin and extending on from that. This is, after all, the 100th anniversary of the Scopes trial, which in the U.S. was a big moment where science and evangelical Christianity were placed in opposition, as if there could be no possibility of having both of those worldviews survive.
Was this around the teaching of evolution in schools?
That's right. And so there was a legal case brought against a high school teacher who taught evolution in Dayton, Tennessee, which was against the law in Tennessee, and he was convicted, but it became a national spectacle. And Christians were made out to be backward and basically denying obvious facts, and scientists were made out to be all atheists, and it set a really bad tone, especially in the South, for this relationship, which at some level has persisted until now. And so a little recollection of that seemed to pop up at the point where science is saying, this is going to be good for you. And people of faith are going, I don't know about that. Well, is there an agenda here? And of course, as you know, Sam, there were all kinds of rumors and conspiracies flying around, especially in social media, about whether these vaccines had chips in them that were going to allow Bill Gates to track you wherever you went, or they're going to make you infertile, or a whole variety of crazy things that got out there. And some people were susceptible to that, I guess. And I even heard in some churches that were particularly troubled about this speculation about whether the vaccine is the mark of the beast. And you don't want to do that. So it was an unfortunate time of great stress on everybody. And that's maybe at a point where misinformation has a particularly strong ability to jump in and discourage people. It was also the case that though the vaccine in its first trial there showed this 95% effectiveness, that was with the original virus. And over the course of time, as the virus mutated and we got other things like beta and delta and Omicron, the vaccine was less effective in being 95% effective. It was still preventing serious illness and death very effectively. But when people started to hear, you got vaccinated and you still got COVID, they began to question whether there was something else going on here that they hadn't been told straight. I will be honest, as one of the people doing the science communication, because I was asked to do a lot of that, I think we could have done a better job of explaining from the outset that we were doing the best we could with the information, but it was going to change. And when it did have to change, people began to question whether we all knew what we were talking about. And those other voices of skepticism or just frank disinformation got a bit of a purchase in people's minds. And those 50 million people, guided by that, decided to pass this up. And Sam, the terrible tragedy of that, and this is pretty well documented, that in the U.S., 234,000 people died unnecessarily because of this resistance to taking the vaccine. That's an astounding number of gravestones that didn't have to be there.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking that was in part the impetus for your new book, The Road to Wisdom, that this is not just, oh, these are some sort of slightly interesting, far out conspiracy theories on social media. It's that actually in this case, and from your point of view, this was a life and death issue.
Yes, that was the point at which I felt like something's really gone wrong here. That it's one thing to have a debate about a political opinion, but this was about scientific facts. And even some willingness on the part of some voices to say, there is no such thing as truth, so why should we listen to you? This is a real wake-up call, it seems, for our society. If we've gotten to the point where it's okay to say that might be true for you, but it's not true for me, about an established fact, we're in trouble. And we're called as Christians to be people of truth. Mostly people of love, but also people of truth. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And we seem to have lost something along the way that other opinions, many of them politically driven, have caused us maybe not to stick to that fundamental sense of being people of truth. So I felt I had to write something about it, and it took a while to get around to doing so. And I resisted it because I wasn't sure I was the right person to write this book or that anybody would want to read it.
Really?
Well, you never know. It's a contentious time, as somebody who was part of the medical effort to try to address COVID. I got characterized by people who didn't like the answers as part of some sort of government cabal that was maybe somehow trying to convince people to do things that we knew weren't right. I mean, that's hard to imagine that people would think that, but certainly did. I was also the supervisor of Dr. Tony Fauci, who was an incredible public servant during COVID, but then became a scapegoat completely without justification for a lot of complaints about what happened with COVID, and continues to need 24-hour security now because of the way in which he's been demonized. And my association with him meant that there would be people who would think anything I would say was probably not something they wanted to hear.
Some of what you're speaking about there is the very, very extreme end, I suppose, of this conspiratorial thinking. And I do want to ask you about a couple of those examples in a minute. Just before we get there, you dedicate the book to the late Tim Keller, yes. Very well-known pastor of a church in New York City, wrote books like The Reason for God, very influential here in the UK as well. And I was thinking about how Dr. Keller would often talk about presenting your opponents' argument in a way that they would recognize. So if Tim Keller was debating an atheist, he would try and articulate the atheist point of view. And I think it's sometimes called steel manning rather than straw manning. And I was thinking about that as it relates to this conversation. So if we park the very extreme conspiratorial, pretty unhinged stuff, and look at this perhaps milder form of vaccine skepticism, particularly amongst Christians, how would you articulate that? You know, what do you think we were seeing for the kind of average Christian going to church, loves Jesus, but just really wasn't sure about the vaccine? What were the kinds of reasons, and whether then or now, how would you seek to overcome those?
I think the average Christian was influenced not just about information about the vaccine, but the other things that were being recommended at that point to keep us all safe. All of the efforts that were done to try to, as we said at the time, flatten the curve, reduce the number of new infections so the hospitals weren't overwhelmed. And that meant, of course, not gathering together. And that meant churches were told, you may not, in many states, actually hold services face to face. You need to wear masks whenever you're around anybody else. And the arguments for and against that were not as compellingly presented. And frankly, the evidence for those was not as strong as it needed to be. And we can now look back and say, yeah, those things did work. They were not 100% successful, but they did reduce the number of infections. But people began to wonder about that. We're being told to do all these things. And then my business closed. And particularly for people in more rural areas where the incidence of infection, at least early on, seemed to be pretty low. Why do we have to do all these things that are so harmful? Why are my kids not able to go to school when we haven't had a case yet in our little town? So skepticism began to build about the whole enterprise, and then that spilled over into vaccines. So, yeah, I guess if I'm being a steel man, I guess that would be the kind of argument that a Christian might make about, I don't think these recommendations that I'm hearing from the government make sense. I'm part of a group called Braver Angels, so I've listened to a lot of those perspectives, and I'm kind of articulating now what I've heard quite a lot of, that it wasn't just the vaccines that made people skeptical. A lot of it was the rest of it that they just didn't see as making all that much sense for them in their little town.
And I think back to it, and I wonder how much of this was a quote-unquote problem where, as times change, the science does actually change and does adapt. I mean, I think back to masks, and initially it was masks don't make a difference, and then it was, no, you should all be wearing them. And I imagine someone like yourself would say, well, that advice changed because the science caught up and we kind of changed our minds. And it, I guess as a scientist, you want to reserve the right to change your mind as the evidence changes.
Yes. You do. And yeah, what happened there was we recognized to our surprise and dismay that people with no symptoms could be super spreaders of COVID without being aware that they were doing so. And the only way to stop that is to put everybody in a mask. We didn't expect that. Other coronaviruses like SARS and MERS the only people who were infectious were really sick. That was not the case, which was a terrible part of this pandemic, but it required a change. And I wish that maybe from the very beginning, we had said every time a recommendation was made, we're going to give you the best advice we can from what we know today. But what we know today is actually pretty inadequate for what we wish we knew. So don't be surprised if a month from now we have to come back and say, okay, new recommendation, new data. That's probably the way you'd want us to behave. That's how science works. But it wasn't heard that way. It's interesting because most people, if you take advice from your stockbroker and they tell you what to do today and you try to follow that, and then you ask them 2 weeks later and they give you the same advice, you think, well, they don't know what they're talking about. So we expect the stock market to change, but we didn't expect public health recommendations to change. They're supposed to be like right from the beginning and nothing will be any different.
I wanted to ask you as well about the religious freedom aspect of this. Now, I know laws and rules would have changed, been different in different territories, but certainly here in the UK, there was a point, I think, where churches were more or less told you had to close. And at the time, some Christians were certainly very unhappy about that. And I think since then, this has been reflection. I think more Christians, again, would say, was that really right? So how do you respond to the religious freedom argument of some Christians and some church leaders who would say, look, we have a right to meet regardless, and you can recommend and you can request, but it's not the government's position to infringe on my personal religious freedom and tell me I can't meet with God when actually it's really important for me to go to church. What's your response to that argument?
I think that one really comes down to a critical issue about public health, which is our responsibilities during something like a pandemic are not just about ourselves. They're about other vulnerable people as well. I think Christians recognize the importance of being sensitive to vulnerabilities of various sorts. You see that in scripture over and over again, in for instance, the parables in Matthew. So I think the argument why that was at the time a justifiable perspective for Christians or non-Christians is you are trying to preserve the opportunity for vulnerable people who may be elderly or immunosuppressed to be able to stay alive by limiting the spread of this illness. And if public gathering is documented to increase the number of new cases, and then those are going to get out in the community and make more people sick, then it's not, from a Christian perspective, a loving thing to do, to say my needs for gathering face-to-face with other Christians are more important than perhaps preventing the death of somebody down the street who may end up dying because I got infected at that meeting. So you have to put those things in place. I think the perspective of those who really were upset about it is they didn't buy the fact that there might actually be a risk here, not just to themselves, but to other people. That case didn't get made. And I once in a while tried to talk about that as an example of loving your neighbor. You are loving your neighbor by not going to a public gathering, including going to church, because your neighbor might be the one you're saving. Wasn't always a popular argument.
Yes, and I think, you know, your critics would push back on the way your point of view was used in a church setting. So again, our different nations have different views on the division between church and state. But it is true, I think, that you said that you wanted to exhort pastors to use their credibility with their flock to effectively encourage them to get the vaccine. Now, if you're okay with the vaccine, you think, fine, fair enough, what's the problem? Those who are more skeptical, I think, took issue with that and said, well, is France is sort of blurring the lines a bit here? You're effectively a representative of the government. You're effectively telling and urging pastors to get their flock to do something which some would see as a political act, having a vaccine. Mm. That's not what the pulpit's for. The pulpit's for spiritual truth. It's an abuse of the pulpit for a pastor to use their Sunday sermon to urge people to have a vaccine. What's your response to that?
My response is it was never a political issue. It never should have been a political issue. It was a scientific and medical issue. And I do think it's an appropriate place for pastors to worry about the health of the people they care for. They're doing this all the time, visiting people in hospitals, encouraging people to try to stay healthy in other ways. What bothered me greatly is that everything at that point became so political that even a Christian like myself, trying to relay information about what the science said about vaccines, was somehow seen as an inappropriate spokesperson when paired up with a Rick Warren or a Tim Keller, both of whom Franklin Graham, I did a podcast with, trying to encourage regular Christians and pastors to just let's look at this as an opportunity. An answer to prayer has been provided by God. Let's not just look at that gift. Let's open it and take advantage of it. And the fact that that got turned into a political, inappropriate behavior on my part was something I didn't quite expect. I don't think of myself as a political person. I never have. You said at the beginning, I served three presidents from two different parties. I never was in a circumstance where I thought I was being a political animal. I was trying to be a doctor.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99. It perhaps speaks to the theme of your book about the divisive times that we live in, that everything is seen as political.
Yes.
Arguably things that shouldn't be, like medicine and science.
Exactly. That is a diagnosis that is inescapable now. And from what I understand, that's also true to some degree in the UK, but it's really true in the United States. Almost every issue comes down to, okay, what does my tribe say about that? And if there's a point of view coming from my tribe, I'll probably accept that without being too careful about checking the background evidence for it. And if it's a point of view coming from that other tribe over there, I'm going to immediately consider it as unlikely and something I don't want to accept. So we are allowing our own sense of truth to be overtaken by political views, often that are highly incompatible with Christian perspectives, and yet it's happening. And it breaks my heart to see this, and particularly when it has taken over people of faith who should have been in the best position to resist these kinds of incursions of what is often kind of mean-spirited politics. We are people of love. How is it that so many Christians now seem to be people of anger and people of resentment, people of acrimony? We should be people of love, not just for our neighbors, but for our enemies as well. That's what we're called to do. The one part of the Bible I try to read at least once a week is the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, go back, anybody listening, if you haven't done that in a while, read Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Look at every sentence, every word, and ask yourself, how are we doing in that exhortation right now? Man, we are falling so short.
I often think similarly around Jesus' words that you'll know who my followers are because of the way they love each other.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it seems like you know who the Christians are because they're shouting at each other on the internet. To use too broad a brushstroke there, perhaps. I know it's not all that bad. But how much of this comes down actually to an online phenomenon? I mean, to put it another way, what if COVID had happened and the internet didn't exist? Would we have seen less hesitancy around vaccines? Would we have seen fewer conspiracy theories? Because there's something about the internet that actually allows quite fringe points of view, whether they're true or not, but there's something about the internet that allows fringe points of view to travel quite quickly. How much of what you were running up against was a result of everyone spending a lot of time online?
That was a big factor. It wasn't the only factor. Politicians weighed in unhelpful ways. promoting things that scientifically had no justification. We wasted so much time hearing about hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and how those would be the answer. Many of those from politicians or also from various people who claimed to be experts. There was no evidence that those were valuable, and that's been rigorously tested. And even today, there are people who think there was a conspiracy to hide the answer from people who, if they just got access to ivermectin, they would have been fine. So, and that was partly social media, but it was partly other voices in the regular media and in the political realm. And that's shocking. And also a reflection of the sickness that seems to have fallen into the political class at the moment, where your ability to be seen as an effective politician is how many people got excited or upset or angry about something you said in front of a hot microphone, as opposed to let's find the answers and let's work together to help people. We're having a hard time with that right now.
Yes, and I want to talk more about that. But before we get into the wider themes of the book, I said we'd come back to those that really are on the very, very conspiratorial fringe, where it's just completely baseless. You've had some run-ins. I mean, literally, if you Google your name, you will find people on YouTube, you know, finding you in a restaurant and saying pretty defamatory, derogatory things. One of the most infamous conspiracy theorists of all time in Alex Jones found you in an airport, filmed you, and again, said things that are, you know, to say they're untrue is an understatement. I mean, this is very lunatic fringe stuff, but it has a following. What's that been like for you? You've become almost a, you know, I hate to say it, you become a bit of a figure of hate, actually, on that end of the very, very extreme political end. What's that been like for you as a person, as a Christian, to grapple with that? Because it's pretty intense things happening to you in your personal life as a result of your work.
It's disheartening, Sam. I don't know that I ever would have imagined this as a guy who spent pretty much my whole life as a scientist, a physician, working in public service. In a way that hasn't been particularly financially beneficial. And then to be the subject of those kinds of accusations by people who do have a big following, for which you really have no recourse in terms of defending yourself. You may as well just try to stay quiet and hope it passes. That's included some physical threats to myself, to my wife, even to my daughters who live in other states. By people who track down that information. At least one person is in jail as a result of that. It's just unimaginable in a country like the United States that these things could be happening, and they're almost sort of normalized now, that if you're going to be out there in any kind of visible place, somebody is going to go after you, and not just verbally, but sometimes with real physical threats. What's happened to us? Where is our compassion? where are the foundations of what we are supposed to be about love and goodness and beauty and family and freedom, justice, all those things? I think we all say we believe in those things, but the aberrations are more and more apparent.
Absolutely. Well, I'd love to know how we fix this, and I suppose that's where your book comes in, The Road to Wisdom. So how do we get ourselves back on that road to wisdom? What are some of the ideas in the books that you're putting forward to help us with all this?
I'm glad you're asking. Yeah, the first part of the book is more a diagnosis about how we've lost our anchor to truth, how we've started to distrust science if we don't like the answer, and how our faith, which should have been a strong force for love and goodness, has often been overtaken by other perspectives, many of them political. But okay, what do we do about it? The last chapter is hope and a plan of action. I thought about this a lot. So where is the solution going to come from? Can we imagine a change in our political environment where the leaders bring us all back to a place where we actually listen to each other and respect each other? I don't see any sign of that, at least in the U.S., the politicians are more polarized than the country. And that's saying a lot. So don't expect it to come from there. I don't see it coming from the media. because most media outlets have taken sides and they're part of one of the tribal alliances. There's almost nothing there that's trying to pull people back together again, because that just doesn't get a lot of eyeballs. People are much more likely to pay attention if it's something that makes them mad, and there's plenty of that. So where's it going to come from? I think it's got to come from we the people. And each of us, we are the ones who have the opportunity here to turn this around. I learned, again, a lot about this from Braver Angels, this group that brings together people with really opposing views on thorny topics like immigration. And you have to listen to each other. Listen so well that you can talk back to them and say, here's what I heard you say. And they will say, that's what I said. We've lost our skills in that space. Social media has made it easier to just stew instead of actually having a conversation. So I'm challenging in the book all of the people who read it to sign a pledge that they're going to try to be part of the solution. And part of that is reaching out to people who you know do not agree with you on a topic. Invite them for coffee or a glass of wine. And first thing you say is, you know, we don't agree on this issue. I want you to tell me your view, and I'm going to really listen. I'm not going to try to plan my response. I just want to understand where you're coming from and what is the foundation of your own experience that leads you there. And then I'll tell you where I'm coming from. And then maybe we could have a conversation about that, like people who want to be friends and not just tear each other down. That can really work, but it requires people doing that. And the other thing I exhort people to do, and it's in the pledge, is to really look carefully at how you're taking on board information and adding it to your own portfolio of truth. Are you being appropriately careful about not attaching yourself to claims that really aren't justified, but they just happen to feel good? And similarly, are you being careful not to reject perspectives that might be really true and important, but they don't come from your tribe? That's hurting you as a person of truth. See if you can reset your incoming filters to try to do a better job of sticking to what really is based on evidence. And maybe also at the same time, look at what you're currently carrying around in terms of your fund of knowledge and question whether all of it's really knowledge or whether some of it's propaganda. That's a hard thing to do. I can't say I'm perfect at it either, but it's a good start. If we could do those things, reaching out to each other and making sure we have re-anchored ourselves in what is true, then I think bit by bit, one-on-one, and then small groups, and then communities, we could start to recover what Jesus calls us to be, people of goodness, love, truth. And again, I think Christians ought to be at the front of this particular initiative, because we have all the reasons to do so from our faith. Jesus calls us to be the peacemakers.
Yeah. Absolutely. It strikes me that we do as Christians have an immense opportunity there. I know you can apply a lot of what you've just said in a political sense. Debates in this country at the moment over immigration are huge, for example. Mm-hmm. I wonder about also applying it in a theological sense or an evangelistic or an apologetic sense of, to use your example of inviting someone for coffee and, you know, rather than launching straight in with all my brilliant apologetic arguments, you know, can I listen to my atheist friend? I mean, I'm being flippant, but it is actually quite hard. I think I've read research on this that says it, your brain quite literally works harder when you're having to hear a point of view that you disagree with. It takes real effort, doesn't it?
It does, but it's also a moment where you begin to have a chance to appreciate whether your own position is as solid as you thought it was. For me as a person of faith, one of the times that I learned the most about my own faith was when I developed a friendship with Christopher Hitchens, one of the more famous atheists of all time. And he and I sparred a lot about those questions of faith. And he developed cancer, and I spent a lot of time helping him with negotiating some options for clinical trials for his esophageal cancer. But as a consequence, we spent a lot of time together. And he was the master of the effective riposte. If you put forward something that he didn't think quite held up, he would let you know. And I learned some really important things about my faith that actually strengthened my faith. He did not become a Christian as a result of all this, but he did reach the point of saying, you know, I think Christians are actually interesting people. They're not just stupid. So that was part of a progress. So, but yeah, made my brain work hard, and we should do more of that. We should be willing.
I think it's, I mean, you're not saying this, so I'll say it for you, but he was incredibly complimentary of you as a person. I remember the line he put out about, I can't remember the phrase exactly, but I think even that in itself is a testimony, right, for us as Christians. So we may not win every argument or debate, but actually if I can convince an atheist that, hey, Christians can be generous, loving people, and they're not just the people online who are shouting at you. I mean, that is progress of a kind as well, isn't it? To show actually that humanity and that love, the love of Jesus to our friends, regardless of what they believe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I learned that with that interaction with him, and I've had others like that. We mentioned Tim Keller early on and the way in which he approached people with very different views. And you mentioned that also. It began with listening. Tell me about the God you don't believe in. And oftentimes after that, Tim would say, I don't believe in that God either. Now, let me tell you about the God I believe in. That's a very important way to get that conversation started.
Yes, yes. I think a lot of what we're talking about today comes down to trust. And there's something slightly amusing about the fact that we're having this conversation. You're having this conversation with a journalist. And of course, journalists are not trusted. a lot of the people listening or reading to this may work for a church. And of course, church leaders are generally not trusted as much as they were. Perhaps there's even a crisis of trust within science, some of the reasons we've already gone into. I mean, how do we... It does a lot of this come down to who you trust? And I suppose my question is really when it comes to experts, there's been a lot of talk around, well, do we trust the experts? Mm-hmm. Because people like yourself who have studied at the highest level, to what extent am I supposed to say, I don't know, I'm not a scientist, Francis is, I'm going to trust him? And to what extent should we say, well, actually, well, just because Francis is an expert, he's not right about everything, and experts can make mistakes as well, and God's given me a brain. Is there a tension there between, on the one hand, trusting the experts, but then also kind of not? Just because you're an expert, does that mean I have to listen to you?
Yeah, that is a serious issue right now, and some have written books called The Death of Expertise because so many people have become so skeptical of anybody who identifies as an expert. But at the same time, there's something a little ridiculous about this. In our daily lives, we depend on experts all the time. If your car breaks down, you're going to take it to a mechanic who's an expert in how to fix it. You're not going to go to your next door neighbor who maybe once upon a time changed the spark plugs and say, can you please make this work? You depend on people who have the appropriate training. If you need some surgery for something, you are going to go to somebody who's done that surgery before, not somebody who's not even got a medical degree. So we depend upon that, but yet somehow in circumstances where we don't like the situation, we're like, oh, I'll do my own research. And people imagine that, you know, I spent an hour on Google, so I'm now an expert. And I can basically say this other person who spent the last 25 years studying this full time and has written multiple papers about it, I'm smarter than that person is because I did my Google search. What? that betrays a certain amount of hubris, doesn't it? But some of that's going on. So again, one should be a little skeptical. If somebody claims to be an expert, okay, what's the evidence for that? In the book, the chapter on trust, I thought about this a lot. It's sort of, how do we decide whether to trust somebody? And I think there are four things that play out there. One of them is integrity. You want to know, is this a source that's honest, that has a track record of telling things straight, that's not been on the take somehow, had some kind of bad history? Integrity. But second, and maybe most obviously, expertise. Do they have the knowledge? Have they done the work? Can you look at their track record of how they have spent their time to say, yes, this person has exceptional grasp of this topic? The third one, which maybe gets forgotten about, is humility. Are they able to say, I'm an expert on this thing, but if you ask me about that other thing over there, I'm going to say, you should ask somebody else. Anybody who claims to be an expert on everything is probably an expert on nothing. So take those three and you're in pretty good shape. But then there's this fourth one, which is taken, I think, inappropriately strong precedence, which is this source compatible with my views? Are they part of my tribe? Do they have aligned values with me? And that could be a good thing if you're asking, for instance, is a particular theologian somebody whose opinion you might want to pay attention to? Well, okay, is this person actually a Christian, if that's what I'm interested in? But now it's taken this unusually large aspect to it so that you might have somebody with integrity and expertise and humility who's telling you something really important and true. But if they're not aligned with your values because they're in a different political part of the spectrum, you're going to say, no, I'm rejecting that. That's part of our issue. And that's where I think we got to reexamine that.
I've noticed that, and linked to that is the sort of guilt by association as well that you see, where it's like, well, actually, yeah, this looks fine. Oh, but they're friends with this person, who's friends with this person. Therefore, we can't possibly trust them.
That is something that gets more and more precedence now, especially in this era where politics has taken over everything, and it's not just opinion. A lot of it is about extreme loyalty politics. If you are not 100% aligned with that view, then you're a suspect.
So I'd love to know what your hopes are for this book. For a Christian reading it, I mean, I love what you say early on, which is if you want wisdom, read Proverbs.
But definitely.
Clearly, this, you know, you should read Proverbs and this book, I'm sure. But what is your hope for Christians as they do both those things?
Yeah, you're right. They should read Proverbs. But hopefully, this is an opportunity to reconnect with anchors that are really important, I think, for Christians and many of them for non-Christians, but which have gotten kind of loosely attached in a lot of our societal interactions. Certainly to reconnect with the fact that there is such a thing as truth. Don't allow yourself to slip into a circumstance where everything's an opinion. We don't really know whether anything's true. That's a prescription for future disaster. People of faith to reconnect with how that plays out at a time like this in a way that maybe is not being manifested in a lot of our churches, that we are people of love. We are people who are peacemakers. We are supposed to love our enemies too and pray for them and not demonize them. I think some churches have reached the point of saying, well, that might have been fine for Jesus' time, but we're now at a cultural war. No, that's not true. Jesus' time was a lot worse than what we're going through right now. Come on here. We have the guidance we need. We just got to reconnect with it. So much Yes. of, I think, what people have adopted in terms of their views of Scripture are more about the sort of health and wealth parts, not about the sacrifice parts. We should be people willing to be sacrificial to help those who are vulnerable. I mean, look at what's happening with immigration. Look what's happening with global health. How could you, as a Christian in the United States, not rise up when the administration is cutting the funding of programs that have been there since George W. Bush started them, called PEPFAR, that were saving 25 million lives from HIV/AIDS, and now the plug is immediately pulled, and the estimates are 90,000 people have already died as a result of that. How can you not be outraged about that? And the silence is deafening. Where are we? How could we?
Am I right in thinking that Christians initially campaigned for that to be put in? I mean, this yes. would have been around the time of Bono from U2.
Yes, yes. No, and George W. Bush, who was and is a deeply committed Christian, went out on a limb here to make that as a priority and immediately was embraced by lots of other people in the Congress, most of whom were Christians. This is what we're called to do. We are supposed to help those who are sick and reach out to them. That's how the sheep and the goats are going to get separated someday. We want to be on the right side of that. And now, 25 years later, when that's all having a dismantling applied, like almost overnight, where's the outcry?
We've spoken today about some things that you and I think are sure on. I mean, you've written an incredible book, The Language of Gods, which sets out in part your arguments for the existence of God, and you and I are agreed that we are. Sure, perhaps, you know, we can't prove it beyond, you know, can't give you 100% proof, but we are sure God exists. There is evidence for this. You are clearly sure that vaccines are a wonderful thing and that God has allowed us to have them. They should be welcome. I'd love to know, though, what are you not sure on? What are the things where you think, actually, you know, when I get into eternity and God says, yeah, not you didn't quite get that right, Francis. What things you think, yeah, maybe that might have been a bit off? Because I know you don't have that view on the importance of vaccines or on the existence of Jesus. But there must be other parts of your politics or perhaps even your theology that you think, oh, I wonder where the truth is in that.
Well, certainly when it comes to end times, I tend to be pretty confused about whether to adapt to premillennial or postmillennial perspectives. I don't know where I really come down on that. It depends on the last time I thought about it and the person whose opinion I read. But I think we aren't supposed to have an absolute certainty of that, or we would by now. I'm not really clear in my mind what eternity is going to be like. I don't believe that when I die, that's it. But I'm not quite sure what's on the other side. I can imagine things, and I can read about people's descriptions. And, of course, I love C.S. Lewis, so much of what I'm thinking about often comes from his perspective, which is also a bit vague in this regard. And I think that's the way God intended it. In terms of societal issues, I believe that democracy is the best of the possible ways to manage a free society, but I would be the first to say we haven't necessarily gotten it right yet. And what was it Churchill said? It's the worst of all possible situations to try to manage society, except for all the rest, which are even worse. So...
I love that quote. That's one of my favorite quotes. There's a lot of truth in that for sure.
Yeah.
So I know you're retired now from the NIH, but I'd love to know what the future holds for you. Have you got any plans for the coming months and years?
Well, I'm deeply engaged right now in an effort at a time where medical research is under attack in the United States with the proposed budget cuts of 40%, 2,500 grants being terminated without much explanation, many staff being fired. I did not leave the NIH on March 1st voluntarily. That was something I was imposed upon to do. I don't think the American public has understood what the consequences of this. This is where politics has jumped into a place it really doesn't belong. So I'm working on trying to get a whole story bank of patient stories of people whose lives have been greatly benefited by research and who will, in an authentic short video, describe that and get that in front of people across the country so that the significance of what's happening here becomes a little bit more clear, and maybe there might be then more resistance to the dismantling of what has been an incredibly successful, life-saving, noble effort, which is now really in serious trouble. And we have to get that back on track.
It strikes me that is one of the weaknesses of my profession in the media. We're quite good at reporting on what's not going well and this disaster,
yes,
but we're not always so good at stepping back and saying, actually, over the last 20 years, look at this really positive trend.
Yeah, look at cystic fibrosis you mentioned in the outset of this program. That was a gene that my lab discovered in 1989. We finally knew the cause, and that was a promise that maybe we could help people who were otherwise dying in teenage years. Well, here we are now. It took 30 years and a huge amount of work by academic institutions and the government and then ultimately a company. And now with this drug Trikafta, most people with cystic fibrosis can start thinking about how they want to retire. That's just amazing to be able to say that. But it didn't just happen by good luck. It took a huge amount of time, effort, and money, and that's all now being cut. Which, if you want the next breakthrough to happen in a few more years, this is not the right path to be on.
How would you like to be remembered?
Oh my, I'm not quite ready to think about that yet, but maybe I should be. I am 75 years old and I am a prostate cancer survivor, which I'm glad to tell you so far is going okay. I guess as somebody who cared about people, cared about health, cared about how faith can be such a critical part of one's life, even people of science. And maybe played a small role in trying to bring back together the idea that you can have both of those worldviews, that you can, as Francis Bacon said, you can actually read both of God's books, the book of God's words, the Bible, which I read most every day, and the book of God's works, which is nature. And that's what science is charged with understanding. And so scientists are worshiping when they do that. And that's how I think about it. If I can be remembered as having made that point a little bit to a few people, that would be pretty good.
It will be all that and much more, but not for many years to come. Francis Collins, thank you so much for joining me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Been great talking to you, Sam. Thanks for the chance to have this conversation.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.